So yesterday, Jonelle, Paul's sister, and I were sitting on the back porch, and we were telling Kamiji stories, and they're already legendary. I'm sure they're going to become more legendary as time goes on. And one of the things we both agreed on is we would like some more time with Paul. And you say, well, how much more? A little more. Always a little more. And one of the great challenges of life is the challenge of timing, isn't it? Rarely does God's timing seem to align with ours, and timing is about control. We get frustrated with stoplights, especially when we're in a hurry. We get frustrated with delays at airports or when people are late. At a much more urgent level, we get frustrated or anxious waiting on a lab report or a medical treatment to work. Delays in getting married, delays in being able to have a child, delays in job advancement. On the other side, not a delay, but things beyond our control, timing we weren't ready for, like Paul going to heaven. So timing is a matter of trust. And trust is not merely resigning ourselves to the fact that God is boss and we can do nothing about it. Trust implies more than simply being overpowered. It's about relationship. It's one thing to be surrendered to God's timing like a prisoner held at gunpoint. That's the resignation factor where we have no choice. He has all the power anyway, so we're surrendered to his will in a sort of apathetic fashion. But learning to actively and joyfully trust his timing because we're convinced he's really smart and really good, that's quite a different thing. And it's not something that just happens on its own magically and right when we need it. If we're not learning to love God now, we're not preparing to trust God in regards to his timing as we move through life. So we're in the book of Mark this whole year. We're in chapter 5 today, verse 21. Let me read it to you. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was on the lake. And Jesus is acting here with distinct purpose. If you've been with us the last few weeks, you know that it wouldn't have been obvious had you been there that he was acting with purpose. It might have looked even a little bit random. And he's on the west side, goes to the east side, on the east side, goes back to the west side. Sometimes his timing looked terrible. Like he's going across the lake right in the middle of a storm, life-threatening storm. You'd think the Son of God could check the weather. The timing just looks horrible. But on reflection, all of his movements were perfect in their timing. They just wouldn't have looked that way had you been there at the time, living it out moment by moment. So he ministered on the west side, traveled across when a storm hit, and by the way, used that timing in the lives of his disciples and in our lives 2,000 years later. Then he went to the east side of the lake, set a demoniac free, back to the west side, encountered a man named Jairus with a sick daughter and a woman who'd been ill for many, many years. So back and forth, back and forth. What was he up to? Was there purpose in his movement and his timing? Yes, there was. Verse 22, one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there, seeing Jesus, fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come, put your hands on her so she'll be healed and live." So a synagogue ruler meant that he was a key lay leader. He was prominent, respected, wealthy lay leader in the Jewish community. And he tossed away all pride and dignity and threw himself at the feet of Jesus because the need was urgent. The timing was urgent. He had no time for niceties, not in the mood for the sometimes silly games of human protocol. His little girl is dying right now. Jesus needs to come right now. So Jesus went with him. Verse 24, a large crowd followed and pressed around him. Now, if you notice in verse 24, Jesus didn't even speak, didn't remark. He just goes straight to action. So it looks like the Lord is right on the desperate man's schedule, doesn't it? It looks like he's operating with the same sense of urgency this man is. Verse 25, a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and spent all she had, and yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I can touch his clothes, I'll be healed. Immediately her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. So again, here's a person who has suffered terribly who comes into Jesus' life. She'd been bleeding for 12 years, probably anemic by now, perpetually ceremonially unclean in that culture because of her situation, unable to participate in public worship. And now she's financially destitute. And instead of getting better, her money has actually made her worse because she has spent it on first century medical practices. This made her suffer more. Verse 30, at once Jesus realized power had gone out from him, and he turned around the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples say, "You see the people crowding against you, and yet you ask, who touched me?" But Jesus kept looking to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, she knew that she'd been healed, came and fell at his feet and trembling with fear told him the whole truth. So this wasn't magic. She probably thought there was some magic. She wasn't fully aware of who the Lord was. And so she thought, if I could touch his cloak, there's some kind of magic man. But that's not what happened. She was exercising faith, a little bit of faith, and she was healed. But why is she trembling with fear? Think about this woman. She hoped she could touch his clothes, not even his body, and she'd be healed. And then he wouldn't know about it. I mean, how could someone know if she touched his clothes because there's a crowd all bumping up against him? And she wasn't supposed to touch anybody in her condition. She really wasn't supposed to touch a rabbi, a teacher like Jesus, because she was unclean, and her touch would make him unclean. But in her desperation, she said, I'll just touch his garment. And the Lord immediately knew that something had happened, that someone had touched him in faith, and that healing power flowed out of him. And Mark wrote that she was trembling with fear. Now, this is no metaphor. She was physically shaking with fright. And we're seeing a theme here, aren't we? The last 3 weeks, what have we seen? Fear. Disciple feared Jesus after he rebuked the storm. The pig herders feared Jesus after he took authority over the demons. Now, this woman is trembling with fear. And often the pictures of Jesus that have been painted or portrayed in film show him as anything other than someone to be feared. He often looks more like someone who spends his days reflectively sipping lattes and speaking just below a whisper. You know, Jesus, can you speak up? It's loud in here. What? Okay, I can't hear that. And I like lattes. No slam intended here. But the biblical picture of Jesus is this brilliant man, this man of discipline and physical stamina, able to walk great distances, able to fast for long periods of time, pray all night, a man who spent his first 30 years in physical labor, a man who intimidated demons and kings and generals. A man the power brokers of the time wanted to kill because they were afraid of him and what he would do. And if Jesus walked the streets of Wichita today, the two most common emotions he would evoke would be fear and love. And only love would enable a person to get past the fear. So now stop and be this woman for a moment. She's a perpetual outcast. 12 years she's an outcast because of her physical and because of what they thought spiritual uncleanness. No doubt she smelled of disease. She learned to fade into the background. She learned to stay away. She learned to blend in. And her desperation forces her into a crowd where she hopes to test Jesus and quickly disappear. She's looking for a stealth healing. No one has to know. So this is a real person. Now be her for a moment. Her heart is pounding. Would your heart be pounding? Boom, boom. You could hear it in your eardrums. And then he calls her out in the crowd. And now her heart goes from pounding. What happens next? Her heart stops. I don't mean literally stops, but her heart, you know, up in her throat. And she fell at his feet. The second person who did this in the same narrative, first this leader, now an outcast, and she confesses what she's done. Maybe she's getting ready for a rebuke. What are you doing touching me? But he said, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be free from your suffering. Now there's no rebuke. Instead, she hears these loving words from the Lord. Your faith has healed you. Go in peace. And the word peace there is not just like a peaceful feeling. It's a word that indicates well-being because of relationship with God. So she got more than she hoped for here. Meanwhile, Jairus has got to be stressed to the max. Okay, she's healed. Let's go. My daughter's in urgent need. And then he hears the dreadful words. While the Lord was speaking, some men came and said, Jairus, your daughter's dead. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Now be Jairus. Be Jairus for a minute. He's gone numb at the words. What do you think would happen? The crowd noise turns into this buzzing sound. Maybe something like what happened to you this past week when you heard the news. Maybe he feels like he's going to faint. And then there's this sound as he's just numb. Jairus. 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 Don't be afraid. Just believe. And Jesus is brilliant. Once again, he didn't have crisis intervention training and help with people who have gone through post-traumatic stress. He just knows people. He made people. And he knows when someone's flooded, you give very simple, direct instruction. Jairus, look at me. Don't be afraid. Trust. And there it is again. The antidote for fear over and over in Mark is faith. Not courage, but faith. Courage comes from faith. Verse 37, he didn't let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And when they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. So when he arrived, he encountered these paid mourners who were waiting for the little girl to die, and they were hired to promote the idea that, oh, there's widespread sadness over the loss of this life. And it sounds like a crazy, crazy cultural norm. It's still around. There's a company in Dallas that they have paid mourners who you can hire to come to your loved one's funeral, and they're trained to mourn loudly and make it look like this person was really loved. So this kind of nonsense is still around. Verse 39, he went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? This child is not dead but asleep." Now Jesus knows she's physically dead, but why does he use this kind of language? And we'll see why in the way he speaks to the little girl, not as if she were dead, but as if she were asleep, because death implies permanence. Sleep is something that is temporary. And death is not a permanent condition any more than a good night's sleep is when Jesus is involved. And so first he has to deal with these people who don't belong there. He has to deal with the ones who are playing games with precious things, like people's grief. So he said that, and they laughed at him, but he put them all out. He took the child's father and mother and disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. So the fake mourners, they stopped their play acting and laughed at Jesus when he said she's only asleep. And he put them all out, it says. I really want to know how he did this. I don't need to know, but I like to know. I mean, did he just look at them and they slithered away in fear as they're all there? Ah! And they left. Did he cast them out like he cast out Legion, out of the demoniacs? He wasn't tender with people who play games with sacred things, like truth, life, death, children, the grief of a parent. But he was very tender with the parents, and he took them into the body of their little girl, and he was tender with the little girl as well. He said to her, took her by the hand and said, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." And this is what like a mom would say to her child. A good translation would be, "Honey, honey, it's time to wake up." That's what he said. Little girl stood up and walked around. Now, by the way, on a side note, our Paul is fully alive and fully awake right now. And if you can't imagine a man as fully alive as Paul being dead, no worries, he's not. He's alive. Let's go back to the theme of timing. Here's a woman who bled for 12 years. Why does she have to wait so long to be healed? If she was going to be healed, I mean, it's not God's will that he's going to heal everybody, but if it was God's will for her to be healed, why not get on with it? Why wait 12 years? The little girl who died, Jesus was just a few minutes late. Why did he stop and speak to the woman? Why put the parents through that shock and grief? And we know now it was for his glory, but if you were there, you wouldn't have known. His timing would have seemed all wrong. And the day is going to come when all his timing makes sense to us, but how do we learn to embrace his timing now? His timing can be confusing, exasperating, it can seem all wrong. Timing, they say, is everything, and I would have to agree. But the phrase assumes something like we have control over timing, and certainly in many things we do have control over timing. But the fact, and because God's given us the ability to move into our world with a will and choose, but the fact that we have control over so many areas of timing can deceive us into thinking that we have control over our life timing in ultimate ways. In the field of psychology, there is this fascinating thing called heuristics, which are the simple, efficient rules that people use to make decisions. And without heuristics, life would be impossibly cumbersome. So for instance, this morning, and we've talked about this a couple of years ago, but this morning you did a vast number of things without actively thinking about them. So for example, you didn't say, let's see, put hand on knob, open drawer. Now, there's a lot of items in there. Which one? Toothpaste would be good. Now, I need to make a decision. All these things in the drawer, what should I put toothpaste on? You didn't do that. You walked in the bathroom thinking of everything except brushing your teeth. You walked out of the bathroom having accomplished brushing your teeth. That's heuristics. And so the problem is when that very helpful thing where we turn life into a series of kind of unthinking tasks that allow us to move through without being overburdened by all the many things that we do, this gets over-applied. And these mental shortcuts become applied in more complex situations. We become overconfident. We start applying heuristics into key decision-making relationships, determining what's valuable and true and what's real. So heuristics are helpful in many instances because they don't load our mental processor down with meaningless details, but we can become overconfident in our ability to move through life, exercising control over a number of small decisions and events. And we start doing this automatically, unthinkingly, and it starts spreading. So this explains one of the reasons why key leaders fall when they get to key positions, because over the years they have developed these decision-making processes and they've worked. And so they become very successful and they become generals and they become senators and they become executives. And then they've trained themselves to believe that they're ultimately in control of all these timings and details. They come to trust their instincts implicitly, and then they fall because they never were that trustworthy. The stakes get high, their instincts become something they trust, and then the fall is great. And what's most devastating is their years of success in trusting their instincts has made the fall even higher. Much better if they learned, even as they went and moved up, if they learned to be suspicious and not so self-confident of their instincts and their ability to control all of the timing of their life. On a side note, this is why parenting is so important, because helping children see cause and effect, when the effects of a bad cause are a simple parental punishment versus jail time or divorce or some serious loss. Really critical that we help children learn to understand cause and effect before it becomes devastating. So we've trained ourselves over time to believe we're in control of timing, and in many ways we are. But we have to be wise enough to know the difference between what we're responsible under God to choose and what we must trust God with, and not confuse the two. So that one of the reasons we come together and worship each week is to reorient ourselves to the reality of God, week after week. One of the reasons I hung out with some friends for lunch this week twice was to reorient ourselves to the reality of God in our lives, in the midst of the details and the timing that seems wrong sometimes. We're responsible to choose, but He's God, and we have to learn to trust Him. And to truly trust Him, we have to learn to love Him. We're responsible for the choices before us. At the same time, we keep turning to God, trusting Him completely. And there are two ways we tend to try to control timing. One is an emotional attempt, and the other is a more rational one. Emotional would be like Matthew 6:27. Who of you by worrying can add a single hour to his life? So we unthinkingly believe we can worry enough to have some impact over outcomes. You say, well, Terry, that's not rational. I know, but we're not rational. We rarely are completely rational beings. But we keep worrying, thinking we can exercise some kind of control by worrying. Jesus said, you know, that's not going to work, don't you? Well, then we go to the rational mode, James 14. Now listen, you say, today or tomorrow we'll go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, make some money. Well, you don't even know what happened tomorrow, James said. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while, then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we'll do this or that. This is not a verse against planning. The planning is very important in the Scriptures. It's about when you're planning, make sure you're sane about it. Make your plans. God is in control. So the big question is, how do we become people who trust God with His timing? Is it possible to not just be God's prisoners of war and to actually learn to trust Him? Yes, but it's going to involve learning to love God, not just fear Him. Over and over, we've looked at the theme of fear and how coming in the presence of Jesus and His power and control over timing brought fear, but people responded differently when they learned to love Him. We looked at that verse in 1 John last week, that love casts out fear. Hebrews 2:14 says, since the children, us, have flesh and blood, He too, Jesus, shared in our humanity so that by His death He might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. So the power of death the devil holds is not the ability to decide when I die, but it's specified here as this fear factor. Fear because of lack of control. We don't control the timing. Jesus destroyed this power, this fear factor, by His own death. He had control over the timing of His death. He decided when it was the right time. He allowed Himself to be captured and killed. There were times when they tried to capture and kill Him, and He would just walk through the crowd. It would part. He released His spirit at the right time, and He came back from the death in death's final defeat. So a trust relationship with Jesus is the path to freedom from fear and His control. The famous Psalms 23, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for You are with me. Your rod and staff, they comfort me. So what's the key to not fearing evil in the valley where death's shadow looms? God is with us, protecting and leading us, relationship with Him. Learning to love is what leads to trust replacing fear. Now, one of the problems with us learning to love God or others is that we've been trained by our culture to believe that love happens or it doesn't. Love comes mysteriously. Love leaves just as mysteriously. Love is something that happens to you, kind of like the wind blowing. And this line of thinking is the cause of untold grief and brokenness, because love is a result of investment. You know, we loved Paul because of his investment in us and our investment in him. When you fall in love with somebody or something, there's no mystery. It's a result of your investment. Your heart will always follow your investment. It's the way God made us. Where your heart is, there your treasure will be. Investment implies time and effort and commitment and loyalty and all that. So is it possible, is it realistic to grow in this kind of confident love for God? Yes, it is. Such that love replaces fear over time. Yes, it is. Such that we're able to grow in our ability to actually trust His timing and not just tolerate it. But we don't just sort of hope it happens to us someday. And for a lucky few, it does. They sort of become people who love God and trust God. And for the rest of us, not so much. We just weren't so lucky. Some people sort of magically happens. They grow in faith. I don't know how. They were just lucky. When the rest of us, you know, it's just not happening to me. Remember 2 weeks ago we talked about the need for training to trust? And training is a loaded word. It can seem to be in opposition to grace, but it's not. It's a biblical word. Train yourself for godliness. Training is cooperation with God's grace. Here's another verse this morning that talks about training. 2 Peter 1:3. His divine power has given us everything we need for life and godliness. What? Everything we need for the kind of life He's called us to? I'm not sure if I believe that. Do you believe that? I really do believe that. Through our knowledge of Him who has called us by His own glory and goodness, and through these, He's given us His very great and precious promises so that you may participate in the divine nature and escape the corruption in the world caused by evil desires. Fancy way of saying God has given us all we need to live the kind of life He has for us. It's important to get this. He's given us access to His power to live the kind of life He has for us. In verse 5, and for this very reason, what very reason? That very reason. He's given us access to power. Make every effort to add to your faith. What? Make every effort. Because God has given you access to His power, you can make every effort. It's not just meaningless effort. It's not vain. Add to your faith goodness, to goodness knowledge, to knowledge self-control, self-control perseverance, perseverance godliness, godliness brotherly kindness, Philadelphia, brotherly love, agape love. And if you possess these qualities in increasing measure, they will keep you from becoming ineffective and unproductive in your knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. So what's the very reason we're told to make every effort? Well, it's the fact He's given us access to His power to live the kind of life He's called us to. And because this power is real, relationship is real, our efforts in pursuing Him matter. Make every effort to add to your faith because God has given power such that your efforts matter. Don't be confused here. There's two separate things. There's justification. We've said this before. There's justification. We can't add to what's been done for us in terms of earning our own salvation. We can't. We're justified by faith alone. His grace, by grace you've been saved through faith. This is not about becoming a Christian. This is about growing as a Christian in faith and love. And clearly our effort is key in accessing and applying the power He's made accessible to us. And then He gives a list of qualities here that are really beautiful. You should read this passage, but we're beyond the scope of our discussion this morning. But the final one is love, agape love, God's kind of love. And so the bottom line of this is the norm for us is that we should be growing in these things in increasing fashion. And the result of increasing growth in those, we're not going to ever get there in perfection. This is about a direction. The result of this growth is a productive and effective knowledge of Jesus Christ. What does that mean? It means this is not just spiritual mumbo-jumbo, not just church talk from preacher guy. It's not spiritual talk that never makes it to the street or the office or the battlefield or the classroom or the hospital room or the funeral service. This is a spiritual reality that's every part of our lives. So productive and effective knowledge of Jesus means we're changing in ways that matter, ways that impact our lives in really important ways now. And if we don't even believe this is possible, we're never going to move that way. We're not going to make every effort to move that way if we don't even think it's real. This is not just about salvation as eternal life assurance. This is about a different kind of life now. Justification. All about God doing what we can't do. You're guaranteed you're going to see Him when you die. Sanctification is effort in cooperation with grace to become more like Jesus. The Lord was never random in any of His timing. In fact, all of His timing was perfect, Romans 5, 6, that you see at just the right time, kairos, God's timing, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. So we can submit ourselves to his timing because we have no choice, like resigning ourselves to a mind-numbed apathy, living like God's POWs. We can refuse to submit to his timing. We can shake our fists and curse the heavens when his timing is all wrong. Or we can learn to grow in our love for him. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're always going to like his timing or the result of waiting on him, but it means we're going to become more and more people who are active, not passive, joyful, not miserable in our trust. We can grow in our love for God, and that leads to trust. And that will include trusting him with timing. And I watched this happen for Paul. Jonelle and I talked to this. I saw this happen in Paul for 30 years. He suffered terribly in many ways in his life. But I'm telling you, the guy made every effort to add to his faith. He exerted his own will, and he completely trusted God's grace at the same time. And he was a changed man. You can talk to his sis. He was a completely changed man. His love for God was real and growing, and it impacted his ability to trust God's timing in real and tangible ways. So do you believe this kind of change is real? Is it possible? Is it relevant? Is it necessary? It's all of those things. Do you a really practical application we've talked about before, but do you pray believing that it matters if you pray? Not just, well, I pray because it makes me feel better, but it really doesn't matter because God's going to be God. No, God's not honored when you say or think, your timing is fixed, I can do nothing but resign myself to it. He's honored when we talk to him about things that matter to us, when we don't necessarily understand it, but we do know that when we talk to him and ask him, it matters. It matters. We're not just passive. Our choices, our prayers, our efforts matter. He's not playing games with us. We can be people who have a productive and effective knowledge of Jesus, which is a knowledge born of relationship that impacts our lives. It's not just what we have up here. And a productive and effective knowledge means it moves out into our lives. So it's a kind of relationship with God that is learning to love him, which means we're learning to trust him, and which means we're learning how over time. It'll be a process that will go on until we see him face to face. But this is a process where we're supposed to be forward movement. Not apathy, not anger, but increasing confidence. Now, he is patient. He's not unkind with our struggles. He's not unkind with our immaturities. So if you feel like this is not me, Terry, I'm apathetic and angry, he's not going to just kick you to the curb. He's very patient. But my point is you don't have to stay there. We don't have to stay there. He's not going to be impatient with us in our immaturity. But the fact that he's loving and patient with us doesn't mean that we don't want to take him up on the offer to grow, does it? I mean, we can become more mature. We can become more confident. We can become more trusting. We can love him more. He said his divine power has given us everything we need for life and godliness. Therefore, make every effort to add to your faith. Let's pray together. Talk to God about your life. If you feel angry, apathetic, confused, talk to him about that. If you would like to grow, go further than you are, I know I would, talk to him about that. He is happy to cooperate, happy to empower.